This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Brainwave series and today we're discussing how our brain learns under stress. Now, kids and adults alike have had to deal with much more stress this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And one of the hardest hit aspects of our lives has been education, with schools and universities shut and lessons having to move online. So we take a look at how we learn and how stress affects our brain's ability to remember and learn. With me on the line, Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist in our Brainwave series. Welcome to the show, Dr. Azlina. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much. It's nice to see you, Mira.
Yes. You know, it's coming up to the end of the year, and I'm sure you've seen a fair bit or participated in a fair number of online classes yourself. What have been some of your observations when it comes to learning? Did you find that children are under stress, your university students, and how are they coping with it?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start with my own experience. You know, there have been a number of like webinars now, you know, and sometimes it gets really hard to follow. It's quite, and if you have, you know, meetings, especially with other people, it's actually quite exhausting, this kind of online method of following things. I think we're not used to that, especially if all our videos are on and we're all looking into what everyone is doing so intently, right?
Yeah.
It's actually another level of, you know, something that our brain has to handle, which is not quite used to handling. For me, sort of watching my own children learn online for the last number of months, it's also been quite difficult for them, I think, because perhaps the method of delivery is not so well suited for an online platform, especially for children. I think, you know, for me, thankfully, I teach university students who are adults, and so we expect more from them, I suppose, that, you know, they're able to sit still and pay attention. Yeah. But when it's, you know, children in primary school and lower secondary, I think it's, you know, it's a lot to expect them to sort of sit, you know, for hours on end. And again, you know, all you have is just this sort of screen in front of you. So it has taken a while to adjust, I think, you know, and I find as a parent, I've had to supplement, you know, quite a lot to kind of try to get them to recap kind of what they learn and try to find other ways of helping them. So you know, quite difficult all around, I think.
Okay. So what's happening in the brain during this type of learning platform? It's changed, right, as you said. And you said you are doing recaps and stuff with your own children. Why do you think that's actually needed? What's going on in the brain when they learn it, you know, with this method?
Yeah, so I think when you have an online platform, there are a number of things, okay? So number one, you're sort of really focused on, a lot of it is hearing, right? It's a lot of hearing. And a lot of the teaching happens in very static slides, you know, whereas perhaps in class you have a lot more animation, you know, you get the teacher kind of moves around or is a little bit more animated, draws, you know, that kind of thing. So then that then helps to, you know, get you thinking a little bit differently, right? Whereas on online platforms, it tends to be quite straightforward and dry. You know, it's slide upon slide upon slide.
Yes.
And you have to listen very intently. And sometimes the font and the images, you know. So those are kind of brain regions that we normally use in a classroom. But it's, you know, even subtle differences, you know, can have a huge impact, especially younger children who are still just very much getting used to learning in that kind of environment. Yeah.
But wouldn't you think that young children are used to this platform? I mean, they've grown up with gadgets and looking at a screen and listening. Do you think their brain is now wired or has gotten used to that sort of learning?
I think yes. So yes, they are very much in tune with devices. You're absolutely right. And that is where I think the classes where they do have fun with are those where the teachers involve them a little bit more in games and quizzes and that kind of stuff. But, you know, not everyone does that, you know, and because it's actually, you know, from a teacher and also from a lecturer point of view, we may have the best in mind for the student, but sometimes it takes a lot to kind of develop those sort of teaching aids as such, you know. And particularly during the CMCO period when there was an almost sudden shift, when suddenly you had to move everything. So it takes a lot to kind of transfer that onto an online platform. But yes, most definitely, you know, the students respond much better when you have some kind of quiz, or when you, if you ask them questions, you know, because those are the things that, yes, they are used to. And actually, at my university, they were very good. Actually, they gave quite a number of lectures where they taught us, you know, they taught the lecturers all the different kind of new cool things that we could use, you know, different apps. And that gave a lot of ideas. So I think, yeah, you know, now that we know what works, it's going to become more part of that learning platform.
Let's take a couple of steps back. Because learning is tied to memory, what is the pathway involved in the brain that enables us to remember what we've learned and what we're retaining, and what's happening in the brain when we learn something new? And how has this platform, different platform, changed? Or do you think the brain has had to evolve and get used to this new way of how we're learning and remembering things?
Yeah. So for the first question about how memory forms, right, when we learn things, how does that learning experience become a memory, right? Number one, if we think back about how we learn certain things, something, for example, like our alphabet. So how did our parents teach us that? It was, number one, through repetition and also, you know, pointing out, drawing somebody's attention to it. So all these posters with very bright colors, and you also kind of, you know, you begin to associate it with different things like R for apple, you know, kind of stuff like that, right? And so that is part of the learning process whereby you are trying to keep introducing that person to the same concept over and over, and that actually helps to strengthen that memory, right? And then the other thing that's really important is association. So it's very difficult to remember facts if they're just on their own. Yeah. Like, you know, if you ask somebody to memorize all the capital cities in the world, you know, they might be able to do it, but then after a while they forget. Okay, but what actually makes them remember is when they start to sort of, you know, make a story of it, or they've been there before. So then they have, you know, an association with being at that place, or you give them lots of pictures, you know, or they have to draw it, or, you know, make a connection or something, you know, something additional to just learning dry facts. So association really helps. The other thing, of course, during learning is the motivation. This is where people start talking about like conditioned learning. Like you give someone a reward for achieving that particular task, and that reward is very important because that sort of sets the mind in the mood, right? By doing many different things, it helps you to pay more attention. If you're more motivated to learn something, then you pay more attention to it. Just an example I always give to my students is, you know, you go to a party and perhaps you meet so many new people. And if this is the era before smartphones, right, everyone's sort of giving you their phone number and you sort of try to remember, but there'll be this one person who you're particularly interested in, and their phone number is the one that you're going to remember out of all the others because you are motivated to remember that, okay? And when you talk about that, is also some kind of emotional content as well. So if an event or a learning process that made you happy, you tend to remember. So you tend to remember experiences that were joyful, where you had fun with your friends. But similarly, you also remember very traumatic events in your life, again, because of this very strong emotional content. But that also boils down to the association that you have. So actually, when you learn, the best thing to do is you're trying to kind of activate many different parts of the brain at the same time. And by doing that, that actually helps to strengthen the synapses or the connection between the neurons. And by doing that, you actually see physical changes happening in the brain. So actually a memory is not just like a fleeting thing that happens in our brain. It's actually, you can see it physically. You can measure physical changes at the synapses.
So which part of the brain is actually tied to memory?
So many, many different parts. So you have, you know, you have your declarative memory, you have your episodic memory. So for example, you remember events, you remember who's there, you remember what you said, you know, that is what we call episodic memory. Then you have, vocabulary, you know, verbal memory, then you have emotional memory. So different parts of the brain kind of control different things. So for example, and of course, one that we have spoken about, or spatial memory, so memory about space. So those different types of memory, so for example, the hippocampus controls spatial memory as well as episodic memories, right? And other types sort of related to emotion as well. So that is there. But then sort of for memories that are like ABC and all that, then that is sort of kept more in other parts of our brain, like in our frontal cortex, so where longer-term memories tend to be stored. And then you have like motor memory as well. So how do your muscles remember how to move? Like if you think of sportsmen or sportswomen, who you know have been training how to hit that racket properly to get the right serve, you know, gymnasts, musicians, their muscles need to move in very fine-tuned and specific ways. Actually, that is also a form of memory, and that is stored in the cerebellum. So many different types. So that's why when you have a stroke, for example, if you have a specific damage in one part of the brain, you don't get all your memories lost. You tend to get very specific defects in memory. And that is because of this sort of, you know, decompartmentalization, I guess. But they all talk to each other, right? They all connect to each other, but they're all sort of kept in slightly different areas. They're processed and stored in slightly different areas.
Okay, we'll come back and find out how stress comes and disrupts this process, given what we've been through in the year that's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sifisodhi. In our Brainwave series, Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, talking to us about how our brain learns under stress, given what we've been through in 2020. We have all had to change our mode of learning. Our children have all been learning online. I think you've explained at length, Dr. Azlina, what actually is happening when children learn in that sort of situation, how it's even more difficult for us teaching these students, because, you know, it involves different, you said it's listening is so heavy, it was so heavy on listening, visuals coming next, so much missing in the ordinary way of how we would teach and learn. And so given the stress that, you know, on top of all of this, we've been through a whole load of stress, just coping with the pandemic, and learning online, not being able to socialize with your friends, that sort of thing. How does stress affect the whole learning and the memory that you were just talking about?
Yeah, so actually, it has been shown that stress can have a direct effect on how we learn, and strangely enough, that stress can be good and bad. Right. So, for example, you know, if you're doing some last minute studying for an exam and you're under stress, you know, you find that, oh, actually, I perform better. Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, perhaps many students feel that way.
Yeah. And what's the reason for that? Why do some people do better under stress?
Number one is in the attention that you give. Right. And in the motivation, like I said before, you are under pressure, and so you're motivated to get this done, right? You need to remember the facts. So when you're motivated to do something, you turn your attention to it, and that helps, you know, that helps. And what happens in memory is that if a lot of things happen at the same time, you know, if you are activating many different parts of your brain, that will help. Now, the problem with that is that sometimes that doesn't translate into a permanent form of memory, right? Because, for example, if you're studying, if you're doing last minute studying for a test, okay, so you kind of you pay a lot of attention to the facts and you try to cram it in, and you kind of do repetitive, you know, chanting to yourself to remember the facts. But then the brain is remarkable that it will be able to store that information for a while. Okay. But because you now, after the exam, you don't come back to it. So now you don't further activate those same pathways or those same connections. And so then after a while, you tend to forget things, right? And so the best way to remember is through this repetitive learning and association. So a lot of the time when you do last minute studying, you don't have enough time to associate, right? You don't have time to become creative with making stories. So you're just sort of cramming, you know, and then you blurt it out and then you forget, right?
Are you then saying that people whom we refer to as having a photographic memory have all linked what they have read or learned to some sort of motivation?
Okay, so...
And so they remember it for a longer period of time. And are you saying that all of us can do it?
So people who have these sort of unusual abilities, unusual, and I'm very jealous of them, abilities, is actually how their brain processes things is most likely slightly different from the rest of us, from the rest of us mortals, right?
Yeah.
There will be, I mean, if you look at people who have photographic memory, most of them, okay, will have that trait from very early on. So that means that, you know, they have been born with some variants in genes, right? So we have the same genes, but they have a slightly different form of gene than ours. And so their change has enabled the communication between the neurons to work better. And so then that's how you help the memories form, right? Sometimes, of course, people can acquire good memories, like, you know, people who, like this Japanese guy who memorized the whole pi up to 100,000 numbers, right? And that is because of training. You can train the brain. So yes, you know, I mean, if we look at more, I think people who sort of train themselves, we can learn the strategies that they take. The people who are sort of naturally gifted, how we can learn from them is, unfortunately, a lot of the time the way they learn seems effortless, right? But what we can learn from them is perhaps what are the changes that have happened in their DNA or in the genes, right? And we can sort of try to tease apart, okay, well, then that if it means that change in this particular gene has made more of this protein, then now we know, oh, that protein is now really important in this pathway. And so then from a science point of view, then we can understand that is now a really key molecule that we need to look into further. So it helps us understand more about the processes that happen in the cell. But you know, I have a few friends who have photographic memories, and you know, you try to kind of watch them and see what they do, but it doesn't look very different from what I'm doing, and that, you know, they score A's and very, very annoying. So yeah. I've tried Mira to sort of copy, but there's nothing obvious in what they do, unless, like I said, people who are actively training their brains, then you can see what they're doing. But you know, for people who are naturally talented, you know, for example, somebody who a kid who can, you know, dribble the ball so well at three years old, you know, what has he really been done? You know, he's just naturally gifted in that way.
Yeah. So I'm going to now say it's a variant in your gene. So you're different from me, right? That's what you're saying.
Well, I mean, I think it's true, right? I mean, people with photographic memory, then not many of them.
Yes. So we were talking about stress just now and how that affects the entire process in the brain. What's going on? And what about people with chronic stress? How does that impact the brain?
Yeah, so I was saying that so stress can be good because it can direct your attention and give you motivation. But when in terms of when stress is bad, is that when it actually diverts your attention, you know, reduces your motivation. A lot of the time as well, I think, and I'd like to raise the link again with the gut microbiome, I think, because I think a lot of the time when you are stressed, you tend to sort of forget to eat properly, or your diet goes haywire, right? And it's really critical, I think, you know, to understand the real connection that your gut has with brain health, right?
What's your understanding of that, the gut and brain barrier? What is your understanding of that? There's so much debate out there about it. Some people say it is there. Some people say it's not. Some people are into the gut microbiome. Some people are not. You know, where do you stand in this debate?
I'm very much in the for, I think, because there is quite compelling evidence that suggests that even studies from animal models and, you know, and even just looking at the types of factors that are being released by this mitochondria. So, for example, I think in one of the earlier brainwaves interviews that we did, I mentioned that actually a lot of dopamine is released by bacteria in our gut, right? And dopamine, when it's released by the bacteria, it goes into the bloodstream and it goes into our brain. So there's a lot of things, factors that we don't know that's been released by these, you know, good bacteria in our gut, right? So, for example, you can then imagine that if you are stressed and you're not eating properly, that can disrupt the balance, right, of your gut health. And I think we see that often, you know, if we're stressed, then it does affect, you know, we feel a bit gassy, or it affects our bowel movement, for example. And then after that, we feel sluggish, you know, and so you can imagine that, you know, all those things that are making us feel sluggish physically would also have a potential effect on the brain, right? So those are instances, for example, just generally how stress could make it difficult to learn. But there have been, for example, situations where stress might make us forget things, okay? And it might cause us to have unreliable memories, right? So, for example, and this in particular, if you think about crimes, you know, if you can no longer remember the crime scene, and you may mislead people accidentally, okay, as to who the suspect was and that kind of thing. And actually what people have found is that how the stress works is that you have, when you're in a stressful situation, you have a lot of hormones that are released. So the ones that we normally think of are cortisol, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. In our body, and so our hypothalamus, right, will release this hormone, and that hormone will actually, it can interfere with how the neurons strengthen our memory, right? So such that there have been some studies that have shown that if you are stressed before an event, right? And so you have higher levels of cortisol in your body, and then you're given a task to remember, most likely you have difficulty remembering, because you're kind of like that elevated or higher level of cortisol in your body is kind of blocking or interfering with the strengthening of that memory. And also it's distracting you and, you know, drawing your attention away from things. And then if you then have a stressful experience after an event, that can also help to block that memory. So, for example, like if you've been robbed, or if you've had a traumatic event, and somebody asks you, well, you know, what were you doing beforehand? Sometimes it's difficult to remember, right? And it's really interesting, because there's some papers that say when you feel stressed, The phase of during that experience, when you feel stressed, is important. So if it happens before, if you're highly stressed before you need to remember something, it will impact on how well you remember it. If you remember something and then you get stressed, then you also tend to forget it.
Right.
But if you are stressed during that memory, that experience, then you actually remember it more. So, for example, like post-traumatic stress disorder and certain trauma and abuse, you know, you want to forget, but because stress happened at that very that very eventful period in your life, you form a strong memory because things are happening all at the same time, okay? So how the people explain that, and the number of different theories, is that, so when the neurons communicate with each other, okay, they will be passing certain chemicals between each other, okay, to help. So you have one neuron that sends the neurotransmitter over to the next neuron, okay? And then the next neuron also sends back chemicals to the neuron that the donor information, let's say, okay, the donor and recipient. Okay, so the donor sends information, the recipient sends information back to the donor, okay? And that is a normal process that happens. And if you have cortisol that is around at that time, then that strengthening is enhanced.
Right.
But what happens is if your two neurons are not talking to each other, but there's a stressful event that increases the cortisol level, right? Then that memory is not strengthened because those events are not happening simultaneously, right? You actually need, so for stress to be good, you actually need stress and that thing that you're trying to remember to happen at the same time.
Yes.
You know, and I guess, you know, we can also relate to that, right?
Yes.
But if we're chronically stressed and then you're trying to study for an exam, you can imagine that your body is just, it has so much of this cortisol and it's just kind of, you know, in blocking this, the talking between neurons. Then you can see how, you know, you feel a little bit foggy.
But can you train your brain to better adapt to stress?
I think so. I mean, it's definitely like patience as well. It's a learned response, right? I mean, you in some, not all, of course, but in some stressful situations, it's also how your brain is interpreting that situation, right? So what might be stressful to you may actually be small stuff to other people, right? So, for example, you might be really stressed about not wearing the right shoes to that party, but actually, you know, it's not a big deal, right? So, it's a personal experience. So how do you stop yourself from being stressed about wearing the wrong type of clothes or wrong type of shoes or you know, that kind of thing is you kind of take stock of the situation, I guess. You know, you kind of have to sort of take a step back and, you know, try to think, well, number one, can I fix it, right? Do I have any control over that situation? Can I fix it? What can I do to fix it? You know, and normal thing that we do, like, you know, we gather information to help us make, you know, a different decision, for example. There is a way that you can do it. And I think that's, but some people, of course, they're under a lot of stress chronically that sometimes, of course, it then changes into something a lot more serious, like depression, right? And very high anxiety. And sometimes that can be quite difficult to overcome, you know, without long-term help, you know, because I think it gets to a stage where the brain just cannot kind of, it has difficulty, not cannot, but it has difficulty kind of processing, you know, the reasons for why something happened or what you can do. So you feel kind of helpless, you know, and I think if you feel helpless, then you feel that, well, that's even more stress because then you feel that there's nothing you can do about it. So I do feel, I mean, definitely that there are things that we can do and there are interventions that can help.
So would you say then cortisol is a very disruptive hormone and we really need to keep it under control?
I think it can be good in certain situations, right? We can use it to our advantage. You know, but we have to be very careful in being chronically stressed, you know, because cortisol, of course, would not just have an effect on how memories are made, but of course, in other of your body's systems as well, right?
I only know it contributes to belly fat. I mean, I mean, that's like cortisol, bad news, belly fat, stay away from that. You don't want to get stressed.
Yeah, I mean, it most likely also has some impact on metabolism and things like that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. So when it comes to learning and, you know, memory and all of that, what's your message on stress and the brain and how it affects the learning?
Yeah, well, I just like to give a shout out perhaps for people who are doing some online learning, maybe first, you know, maybe if myself included, because I've had to attend many seminars and workshops where I've also had to learn things, and children and parents of children who are learning, you know, I think we have to accept that there will be a level of stress. You know, I think we have to accept that not everything's going to go great, you know, all the time. But I think it's also really important to teach the children. It can be kind of used as a learning process, how to kind of get through these stressful situations. So, you know, for example, issues with, you know, technology, the computer doesn't work, you can't get connected. That can also be another level of stress when you're doing online learning, right? You can't hear the teacher, or you don't understand what the teacher is saying. You don't feel that you really grasped, you know. And I think we can try to make the best of that situation, of this situation that we're in, right? That now we learn that we can't surrender all our learning to teachers, right?
Yeah.
We actually have to be more proactive, you know, and I think that's something I'm trying to teach my children, right? And that's also something that we at the university have sort of tried to relearn, because we always think that we have to fill the brains with all the information and then let them loose into the world, you know, all nicely popped up. But in fact, you know, the learning process requires active input. You know, requires constant questioning on behalf of the person who's learning, wondering, right, curiosity. And so, yes, it is stressful. I've been through all those different stressful moments with my children and also with my own teaching. But I'm trying to think a bit positively. And I think that, you know, the only thing that we can do at the moment, I think, is try to find the silver lining and try to find a way of how we can adapt. You know, because this is probably not going to be the only time this happens.
Yeah.
You know, we've had to change because of the haze even. So who knows, you know, the climate emergency may also cause us to have to learn more teaching at home. So we just have to kind of get used to it. It's great that the brain is really elastic. It's very plastic. It can learn. It can adapt. It's just, we just have to find what works for us.
And are you looking forward to 2021? It's a brand new year.
Very much so.
Yes.
Very much so.
Share your sentiments.
I've learned a lot in 2020. But
agreed, yeah.
Always nice to have a new year ring in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Happy New Year.
Thank you so much.
Have a good one.
Same
and we
you.
Will continue with our shows in January.
Yes, hopefully. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist in our Brainwave series on how does our brain learn under stress on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.